Raymond Swing explains the news. The American Broadcasting Company and its affiliated stations now bring you Raymond Swing and his analysis of History on the March. Before we hear from Mr. Swing, listen to this important announcement. Jingle bells, jingle bells, jingle all the way. Now wait, I know it isn't Christmas yet, but this is just sort of a reminder. If you're going to mail any Christmas packages overseas, do it now. Between now and the holidays, the Army and Navy postal system is going to be swamped, literally, with the greatest delivery problem since the war began. Naturally, the government wants you to send that fellow a girl a Christmas present, but they also want to be sure that present gets there on time and not next July. The one way you can be sure of good delivery is to get the gifts off early. And here's another special request from the postmasters. Do not send packages to servicemen and women en route home or otherwise scheduled to change addresses before Christmas. And when you do send your present, be sure it is wrapped well and addressed plainly, and most important, be sure that the gift is one he'll appreciate and be able to use. Gifts that are not bulky or perishable make the best kind. Now, here is Mr. Swing from Washington.
Good evening. Last Friday, I told a story of the foresight which led to the United States government getting started on building the atomic bomb in time to finish it before the end of the war. The foresight of comparatively few persons was necessary, for it was to be an enterprise of phenomenal secrecy. Now that the atomic bomb has been made, now that it has burst, now that we know the terrestrial power of it, there must again be foresight, but this time not of a few, but of citizens of all the world. During the war, the objective of the foresight was destruction. Today, the objective is to save much of the human race from destruction. To destroy needed only an assignment to scientists and engineers, financed by funds for which no accounting had to be made while they were being spent. To avert destruction requires political action, which has to be based on knowledge and ethics. The Gallup poll turns up this week with an answer to the question as to whether the United States should keep the secret of the atomic bomb. To this, 73% answered yes. But the question really misses the point, since it presupposes that the United States can keep the secret. Assuming that it can, it's only natural that the nation having overwhelming power as against other nations and convinced of its own righteousness will vote to keep the power. It's simply a way of saying, let us remain overwhelmingly powerful. I don't grant it's a wise answer even then, but it's a very human one. However, it is not a factual answer. It has to do only with a world of wishes, not with a world of modern physics. The atomic bomb cannot be kept a secret, and the problem is what to do about it for the very brief time in which our exclusive possession of it is a means of persuasion. Research in nuclear physics, which produced the atomic bomb, is the joint product of the men of many nations. A Russian is credited with having been among the first to achieve the essential chain reaction. Even the Japanese have already made plutonium. The secret of the bomb is more in the domain of engineering than of physical theory. And the physicists in other lands will have good engineers to advise them. So there's no question about our keeping or sharing the secret. We shall have to share it, whether we like it or not. The question is whether to share it now. It would be a terrible weapon in the hands of any government which has yet to demonstrate its trustworthiness. And in saying this, I'm not thinking of any government in particular, but surely any government with fascist tendencies, hence with warlike tendencies, should not be given the bomb, that to start with. But to go on from there, the question is whether any sovereign state, whatever, should be permitted to have the bomb, our own country included. And here I suggest that one must ask, are there to be wars in the future which might involve this country? The answer to that is yes, for as the United Nations Charter is written, wars between nations are possible, and we are sure to be involved in any great war. If there are wars in which our enemies have the atomic bomb, and we have it, the wars promise to be so destructive as to destroy civilization, ours and theirs. And add to the atomic bomb the guided missiles developed by the Germans, and future wars become so catastrophic that they cease to have political meaning. Until now, wars always could be won. At any rate, they decided the national destinies one way or the other for winner or loser. But future wars will be wholly lost by both sides. Furthermore, future wars will not be waged soldier versus soldier, but scientist and engineer versus civilian. Indeed, military wars appear to be over. All wars are to be against man, woman, and child in their homes or their places of work. So the problem is bigger than the atomic bomb and the guided missile. It's the problem of not having wars. The atomic bomb and the controlled missile have put an end to the practicability of war. We must so organize society that wars between nations are impossible. If we have wars, it's almost inevitable that the new weapons will be used. If we try simply to control the use of the weapons and don't abolish wars, we shall be deluding ourselves. So long as there are sovereign states with military power, which they can use against each other, we live perpetually on the threshold of war. So what we need to do is to place all military power in the possession of a union of nations, which will exercise all of that military power and leave none of it to the sovereign states. Then there will be no national wars. Then at worst, there will be police action, either small action or, if some nation tries to secede, big action. But it will not be war for political ends. It will be the police action which enforces the law. In such a conflict, since it will be police action, civilization will be saved and strengthened, not destroyed. The terrible weapons need not be used. Man, woman, and child again will be safe in their homes and their places of work. I notice, among others, two streams of thinking of those who I've heard discuss these problems. One stream approaches the problem in terms of controlling the new weapons, which entails inspection, and which, to mean anything, will have to be international inspection. And the other stream starts off, frankly, with the concept of world government, a limited government at the outset, dealing perhaps only with security, but broadening as the years pass to include further federal activities. The same motion for both recognize the ultimate objective is world government. Both types are useful. But the man who prefers to think of control and inspection is likely to be the kind of man who takes first steps first, without being too sure of the steps to follow. While the man who plumps right off for world government may be inclined to be impatient with the man who concentrates on the next step. I also meet those who think it would be enough to leave the atomic bomb with the Security Council of the United Nations as now constituted. And I know some of the 73% of the Gallup poll who want America to keep the secret. But this can be said to any apostle of unlimited sovereignty that in the world of weapons now being formed, life becomes so precarious as to rank unlimited sovereignty with the finest foolishness men have ever ventured to sponsor. People in such a world would indeed be living dangerously, in a danger never before equaled, and in a helplessness never before conceived. It is astonishing what atomic energy and guided missiles have made of the once reliable doctrine of unlimited sovereignty. The man who plumps for world government has both logic and law on his side, and he makes no bones about it. That is the end result, not the next step, and that interests him most. He finds the world somewhat in the position of the American colonies after winning the war against England. The colonies had a confederation. Each colony was sovereign and unwilling to limit its sovereignty. The world today has something like a confederation in the United Nations, which also is an association of sovereign states. The Assembly of the United Nations is not altogether unlike the Continental Congress of revolutionary days. That Congress had no power whatever other than to approach the separate colonies with requests, pleas, and exhortations. The Confederation won a war, but it was not a government. The United Nations organization is not a government. In one respect, the United Nations organization is more powerful than the Continental Congress. It can operate against member states with economic sanctions and then with military force. But even that doesn't make it a government. A government operates on individuals, not on states. To go back to the debate which accompanied the transformation of our confederation to federal union, Madison argued that government must have the power to tax and to conscript. That is, it must be able to tax the individual and conscript the individual. And when our federal government was set up, it had these powers along with many others. So too, if we're to have world government, even of the most limited kind, it would have to operate against individuals. In the field of inspection alone, in controlling the making of weapons, it would have to have the power not only to enter factories and laboratories everywhere, it would have to have the power, too, to make arrests and to prosecute those who violate the law of the World Organization. And that's the test by which to measure proposals for turning over the atomic bomb to the Security Council with power to inspect and control it. If the inspection and control are not against individuals, the proposals are not coming to grips with the problem. If they are against individuals, they are the beginning of world government and hence of the abolition of war. In the talk of the town, in the current issue of the New Yorker, I find this pertinent editorial. As we listen to President Truman broadcasting his victory message to the troops on VJ night, we wished he had included a paragraph or two from the article by Cord Meyer, Jr. in the current Atlantic. Meyer did a stretch with the United States Marines in the Pacific and later with United States delegates in San Francisco. Of the latter experience, he wrote in current Atlantic, "I have described these provisions of the Charter because I wish to make one point so clear that no one can miss it. The international organization cannot rely on its own power and authority in dealing with the most powerful nations of the world because it has been given none. Behind the facade of what I believe to be genuinely good intentions, there remains the basic condition of anarchy implicit in the existence of absolutely independent nations with large amounts of armed force at their disposal." That, the New Yorker continues, would have been a good passage to read to the troops just before Bing sang "I'm Dreaming of a White Christmas." It's this basic condition that the United Nations organization must hasten to improve, the editorial continues. For as it is presently constituted, the organization has the authority of a yellow butterfly in a high wind. The people know this. The League must grow from league to union, as the name United implies. It must grow and gain authority, first basically through the acquisition of federal power, then specifically through a proper use of this power. Then we can have all the white Christmases and international trials we want to. We can even have a law making it dangerous for any man to be inhuman to any other man. And now a message from our announcer.
Has anyone here seen Euterpe? She's a willowy, graceful girl wearing flowing robes and always playing a lyre or a piano, or even a musical comb if that's all there is around. Some years ago, in case you've forgotten, Zeus helped this daughter of his to become one of the earliest career women, with a title, Muse in Charge of Music. And she's still doing all right for herself. If you don't think so, just listen to the American Broadcasting Company's musical shows. It can't be purely coincidence that America's youngest network walked off with five important honors in Musical America's recent radio poll. Bruno Walter, conductor of the Metropolitan Opera Association, was best of all conductors. The Met's Die Meistersinger, best opera performance. Metropolitan Opera USA, the best program of its character. The Boston Symphony, under the direction of Dr. Serge Koussevitzky, tied for a first place, and Milton Cross was the outstanding announcer-commentator. So just listen to the American Broadcasting Company's musical programs. Copies of Mr. Swing's Friday night broadcasts on atomic energy may be procured through your local station. For keen analysis of the news, listen regularly to Raymond Swing.
How about taking a chance on a blind date? Then stay with us, and coming up in a half hour over most of these stations is the Blind Date program. This is the American Broadcasting Company.